Well, I'm fairly certain that I can say that all of us at one time or another have had the experience of a supervisor, a boss, a coworker, someone like that, who asks us to do something that they're not willing to do themselves. So picture that person for a moment in your mind. And we'll be talking about them and how that works in a little bit. But first of all, we're going to talk about this Sunday. This liturgical Sunday is the Baptism of Jesus Sunday. And the Baptism of Jesus is one of those ongoing, sort of tricky kinds of things. I figure if John the Baptist himself wasn't entirely sure what to do with Jesus showing up to be baptized, then we are allowed a little bit of a confusion about why he was there. John the Baptist knew who Jesus was, not just a cousin of his, not just a relative. He knew who Jesus was. So when Jesus came to be baptized, the first thing he asks is, why? Why are you here? You should baptize me, not the other way around. And yet Jesus was baptized. There's a number of things we can look at, or a number of reasons why we can sort of consider Jesus' baptism. But the one that struck me this year as I was reflecting on this again was when I was reading the Acts portion of the lectionary texts for today, and I was reading him in the New Revised Standard Version. And there it says, it begins with Peter beginning to speak, and he says, I now realize that God shows no partiality. And that's where the sermon title comes from. No partiality means no partiality, period. It's always tricky when you start using the word no or any of those all-inclusive words. If you tell people that you're not going to play favorites, no favoritism, that means no favoritism. No partiality means no partiality. And while it is quite true that what Peter is talking about here, or what the main thrust of his contention that God doesn't show favoritism or partiality, is that salvation is now explicitly, in a brand new way, not just for the Jews. It's for everybody. That God doesn't play favorites. If he ever did before, he certainly doesn't from this point on. Well, why does that connect? And it connects once again through the doctrine of the incarnation. One of those mysterious things that we will never fully understand, where Jesus came to earth fully human and fully divine. And if Jesus was fully human, then it begins to make sense why he would go through baptism. When John says, why are you here? You don't need baptism. Jesus says, I need to be baptized to fulfill all righteousness. This does not mean that Jesus was unrighteous before that. It doesn't make any, there's no suggestion whatsoever that Jesus required baptism to deal with some sin issue in his life. But it takes us back to that mental picture I asked you to have from the beginning. When somebody comes to you, whether it's, as I said, a coworker or a supervisor or, for that matter, a family member or something, and ask you to do something that they're not willing to do themselves, most of us bristle just a little bit. Maybe not all of us. I'm sure many of you are much further along in the road to maturity than I am. But when I hear that, my first thought is, no. If you're not willing to do it yourself, then why should I? It seems to be just a regular human sense that the people who ask us to do things should be willing to do them. When I worked at the Bible College and Seminary a long time ago, I was a director of enrollment. And I had the title director of enrollment because we couldn't find a single person under the age of 30 who had a positive connotation with the word recruitment. And that's what I was doing. I was head of recruiting, getting students to come. And so when a student indicated some kind of interest in one of our schools, whether they filled out a form or they'd been talking to a pastor who let us know what their name was, we would phone them. Now, we have to remember this was back in the 90s when people still talked on phones. If you had a cell phone, you probably used it to talk to people as opposed to texting people and all the rest. I mean, I sometimes wonder what, well, main reason cell phones have speakers is so you can listen to music on them now, more than anything else. But I mean, we phoned. And for most people, talking on the phone was just a matter of course back then, but calling a stranger, someone who, it's not exactly a cold call, it's more of a cool kind of call, they've expressed some interest, but you're phoning them up out of the blue to talk to them about maybe coming to your school. For most people, that was a bit of a challenge. And so when we had new people there, when we had new students coming in to make these calls, what they first did is they would listen to other people making calls. And I made sure that they could hear me making some of these calls, even though I knew they weren't going to be very effective. Somebody did a study, a fairly substantial study, on who do prospective students want to hear from when they're making a decision about where to go to school. The number one is a current student. Number two is a former student. There's 11 categories they came up to. Dead last is the head of recruitment or enrollment. Because, and this was done for all kinds of schools, not just religious ones. They said, well, these are the people who are paid to lie to you, make you come. You know, so for me to talk wasn't all that effective, perhaps, talking to the prospective student. But it said something to the students who worked for me that I was willing to do what I was going to ask them. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to do everything that you're going to ask people to do, but you have to demonstrate a willingness to do even the unpleasant things, or people aren't going to listen to you the same way. My first job, where I wasn't working for a relative, was on the grounds department at the University of Alberta Hospital. I got the job because one of my friend's father was the head of the grounds department, but you know, it wasn't the same as working for, you know, your dad or your uncle or something. So one of my jobs there was to dig out what had been a flower bed. It was on a sort of a corner, and everybody cut through. And so we finally said, well, this is just silly. Like, trying to grow flowers where people are going to walk is just futile. If they're going to walk there, they're going to walk there. Let's at least make it into something else. So my job was to dig out the dirt that had been intended to be a flower bed, so we put gravel or something like that in there. The dirt was like, it was like this. It was like cement. And this was the first time I'd really handled a spade, and I didn't know any of the techniques, because there is technique to using a spade, not just brute force, and I didn't have any of that, and I was in high school. I might have weighed 140 pounds. So I was given this here, dig this out from here to there, and away you go. The co-worker, sort of supervisory kind of guy, Wayne, came by later and just went, is that all you've done? Ugh. Absolutely demoralizing. Because he didn't know. He didn't know how hard it was, and he just walked off. Well, John, who was head of the grounds department, the father of my friend, came by and said, you haven't got very far. Give me that spade. So he took the spade, and he slammed it in and went nowhere, just like I had. And he said, this is terrible. This is going to take you forever. This is really hard. But I think you can do this. I said, well, Wayne didn't think. He said, well, Wayne doesn't know what you're doing. You just dig this out, take as long as you need to. This is going to be a really tough job, but I know you can do it. And he left me. Well, who do you think I sort of thought about when I was continuing the job? It was John. Because, well, first of all, I mean, the encouragement was one thing, but he tried it. He didn't just look at it and say, well, the theory suggests that you should be done by now. He looked at it and said, well, wonder what's going on there. And when he tried it, it was hard. He was willing to find out what was going on. John was somebody I worked for a couple of summers and was willing to do pretty much anything he asked. Because when he asked me to do things, there was a sense that he was willing to do them himself. We respond to people like that. People who sort of look down from the theoretical standpoint that this job can be done in 5 minutes or 5 days or whatever it is. They've never done it themselves and tell us to do it, aren't an encouragement. We don't get energy from those people. We don't get the sense that we can do it. What we get is, well, lots of other things. When Jesus asks us to do things, when we read in Scripture, when we read in, say, the Sermon on the Mount, some of the things that Jesus expects us to do that are not easy, we're willing to undertake them because Jesus did them first. As we've said many times, he didn't do exactly what we're doing now. Jesus never had to wrestle with road rage behind the wheel. But the human impetus to impatience, of course he had to deal with that. And Jesus even did things that were completely unnecessary for him, so that when he asked us to do them, we know that he was asking from the perspective of, I know what this is like. And that's one of the reasons why he was baptized. Frequently, when people get baptized when they're a little bit older and they make a bit of a statement before their baptism, they will say something along the lines of, it's a public declaration of how I'm following God, or it's a public declaration of my turning my back on sin. Not that I'm going to be perfect from this moment forward, but it's a public statement that that's behind me. None of that, of course, applied to Jesus. He didn't have to do that. That's not what he was saying. He wasn't saying that I was sinful and I won't be anymore. What Jesus was saying is that human beings are obedient to the call of God. Jesus, through baptism, gave us another demonstration of obedience. Obedience is a tough word to sell these days. People don't describe themselves as obedient employees. There's something sort of wrong about it. The connotations don't work anymore. So it's a tough word for us to use. But we're called to be obedient to God. We're called to do what God asks us to do. And in Jesus, we have the example of perfect obedience. Obedience isn't a bad word. Obedience isn't being servile. It's not being a sycophant of some kind. It's not caught up in any of that. Obedience is doing what you are asked to do when the person who asks you has the right to make that request. We don't like doing what people ask us when they don't have the right to ask us. Well, they don't. If you're in the shopping mall or something like that, and this is far more prevalent in some places, especially in the United States, a cell phone guy says, come on over, I want to tell you how I can do something better for you. We don't have to go over. We're not being disobedient when we keep going. We're probably being a little more sensitive to the time that we have and the things that we actually need to accomplish. Obedience isn't about just doing what anybody asks you to do. It's about doing those things that you are supposed to do, that the proper people ask you to do them. When I ask my children to behave in the mall, I want them to behave. When other people want my children to do things in the mall, I want those other people to go away. They don't have that right. 25 years ago, 45 years ago when I was a kid, every adult had the right to tell kids what to do. The world has changed. When Jesus asks us to do things, he's asking us from the perspective of somebody who knows what it means to obey. Jesus was fully human. I cannot believe that he didn't have the tendency to bristle about being obedient. He knows what it is to be asked to do things that might be tricky, that might be difficult, that might even be unpleasant, might be embarrassing. So when Jesus asks us to do any of those things, we know we're being asked by someone who understands us, who doesn't just understand the requirements of the job that needs to be done, but understands us as well. And we know more than that, that Jesus will not ask us to do, well, first of all, what he was unwilling to do, and he won't ask us to do what we cannot do. Jesus does not ask us to do the impossible. Jesus frequently asks us to do things that we think are impossible, and then in our own strength we can't do. But when we work with God, the things that Jesus asks us to do can be done. And the person who's asking us has done something similar to it, and maybe more besides. When God said there'd be no partiality, He meant it. Human beings have a requirement to obedience to their Creator. When Jesus became a human being, He demonstrated that same kind of obedience. Being baptized was part of that. We celebrate that this Sunday. And one of the reasons why is because it reminds us once again that Jesus did everything that we are ever asked to do. That He understands the requirements upon us because He fulfilled those requirements Himself as a human being. He didn't take the shortcuts that His divinity might have provided for Him. He did what we're asked to do the same way we will do it. Depending on the Holy Spirit, when we're asked to do those things beyond us, depending on our talents and abilities and our experience and all of those things that have been built into our lives up until this point, we're asked to do what we can do by someone who's willing to do anything He asks us to do and demonstrated it in his obedient response to the call to be baptized. It's good to follow someone who knows what you're going through and is willing to do anything that they'll ask you to do. And in Jesus, that's exactly what we have.